Rules are rules. Henry shook the larger box on his lap, the one with the record, thinking that he might as well take the ribbon off and just get it over with.
Don't worry. I'll take care of it, Mrs. Beatty said. And she did.
On the outskirts of Puyallup, Mrs. Beatty pulled over into the parking lot of a Shell oil gas station. She pulled off to the side, near the back, avoiding the pumps and the service attendant, who watched them quizzically.
"Grab those boxes and come with me," she barked, putting the truck in park before stepping out and walking to the rear of the still-running vehicle.
Henry followed, holding the presents as she climbed up into the back of the truck. Grunting as she bucked a 50-pound sack, she pulled it toward Henry, then untied the knot, jerking it open. Inside, Henry could see it was filled with cowrose rice.
"Give me that."
Henry handed her the presents and watched her stuff each one in a bag, then bury them with handfuls of rice before sealing the bags again. He looked at all the bags, wondering what else must be in there. He'd seen her trading tools with soldiers and occasionally camp residents, things like files, small saws, and other woodworking tools. For an escape? Henry wondered. No, he'd seen old men working outside their shacks, building chairs, building shelves. That was probably where their tools came from. Mrs. Beatty's corner stand on the black market.
"Hey, what are you doing with that Jap over there?"
The gas station attendant had walked around the building and must have been curious about this old woman and this little Asian kid.
"He ain't no Jap. He's a Chinaman. And the Chinese are our allies, so shove off, mister."
Mrs. Beatty hefted the last bag, the one with the record in it, and set it upright against the back of the cab with a heavy thud. The attendant backed off immediately, taking a few steps back to the service station, offering a feeble wave.
"Just trying to be helpful. That's my job, you know."
Ignoring him, Henry and Mrs. Beatty climbed into the truck and rolled on. "Not a word, you understand?" she said. Henry nodded and kept his mouth shut the rest of the drive, all the way to Camp Harmony and right through the main gates. In Area 4, Henry went about his normal routine of dishing up lunch. Gradually, Mrs. Beatty had won over the local kitchen steward, who now ordered mealtime staples appreciated by the Japanese residents, namely rice, but also miso soup with tofu, which Henry thought smelled delicious.
"Henry!"
He looked up and saw Mrs. Okabe standing in line. She wore dusty trousers and a sweater vest, with a large O sewn on one side.
"Are you responsible for putting an end to that awful potted meat? It suddenly changed to a steady flow of rice and fish. You're doing?"
she asked, smiling at him.
"I can't take credit for it, but I'm happy to be serving something I'd actually eat, too."
Henry dished her up a plateful of rice and pork katsu.
"I have a couple of birthday presents for Keiko. Would you give them to her for me?"
Henry set his ladle down for a moment and turned to pick up the presents, which sat at his feet.
"Why don't you tell her yourself?"
Mrs. Okabe pointed to the back of the line. Keiko peeked her head through the crowd, smiling and waving.
"Thank you, I will. Is there anything you need? Anything your family needs? I can sometimes bring stuff into the camp, stuff that's not normally allowed." "That's very sweet of you, Henry, but I think we'll be just fine for the moment. At first, some of the men wanted tools, but some of that's coming in now. Just a hammer would have been a priceless treasure only a few weeks ago. Now there's so much hammering and sawing going on each day, it's a wonder why they go through the trouble." "What trouble?"
Henry asked, not understanding.
"They're just going to move us anyway. This is only temporary. Can't sleep in a horse stall for the duration of the war, can I? I hope not, anyway. 1 month is bad enough. In a few months, they're sending us to permanent camps that are being built farther inland. We don't even know where we'll go. Either Texas or Idaho. Probably Idaho. That's what we're hoping for, anyway, since it's closer to home. Or what used to be home. They might even split off some of the men, those with job skills needed elsewhere. They're making us build our own prisons. Can you believe that?"
Henry shook his head in disbelief.
How's the old neighborhood?
Henry didn't know what to say. How could he begin to tell her that Neomachi was like a ghost town? Everything boarded up, a disaster of broken windows and doors, as well as other vandalism.
It's fine, was all he could muster.
Mrs. Okabe seemed to sense his hesitation. Her eyes glossed over with sadness for a moment, and she wiped the corner of one eye, as if there were a mote of dust bothering her.
Thank you for coming here, Henry. Keiko's missed you so much.
Henry watched her smile bravely, then take her tray and disappear into the crowd.
Oh, I dekte udashi desu!
Keiko stood across the serving pan, smiling, almost glowing.
You came back.
I told you I would. And you look beautiful, too. How are you?
Henry looked at her and found himself feeling lightheaded and slightly out of breath.
It's so funny. They throw us in here because we're Japanese. But I'm Nisei, second generation. I don't even speak Japanese. At school, they tease me for being a foreigner. In here, some of the other kids, the Issei, the first generation, they tease me because I can't speak the language, because I'm not Japanese enough.
I'm sorry.
Don't be.
It's not your fault, Henry. You've done so much since I've been here. I was afraid you might forget about me. Henry thought about his parents, about how they hadn't spoken a word to him in nearly a week. His father was stubborn and traditional. He hadn't just threatened to disown him. He'd gone through with it. All because Henry couldn't stop thinking about Keiko. His mother knew. Somehow she knew. Maybe it was a loss of appetite. Mothers notice those things. That distracted longing. Feelings can only be hidden so long from those who really pay attention. Still, his mother obeyed his father, and Henry was alone now. All because of you, he thought. I wish I could think of something else. Someone else. But I can't. Is this what love feels like?
How could I ever forget you? He asked.
An old man behind Keiko began tapping his tray on the steel railing of the counter and clearing his throat.
I better go,
Keiko said, sliding her tray down as Henry filled it.
I have those things you asked for, and a birthday present for you.
Really?
Keiko smiled with delight.
I'll meet you at the visitor's fence an hour after dinner, okay?
Keiko beamed a smile back before disappearing into the crowded mess hall. Henry went back to work, serving meal after meal until everyone had been fed. Then he carried the serving pans to the dish pit, where he hosed them down with icy cold water, thinking of how Keiko would be leaving again, going to some place unknown. Keiko walked past a different set of guards this time and met Henry at the visitor's area of the fence, just like they'd planned. There were three or four other clusters of visitors along the fence line, with 5 or 10 feet between them, creating intimate spots to converse through the barbed wire fencing, separating the internees from the outside world. It was getting late, and a chilling wind had rolled in thick storm clouds, replacing the normally bleak, overcast sky. Rain was coming.
They just canceled our record party. Bad weather.
Henry looked at the darkening sky, disappointed more for Keiko than for himself.
Don't worry, he said. There'll be another time. You can count on it. I hope you're not disappointed, Keiko sighed. You came all this way. I really did want to sit here along the fence and listen with you.
I didn't come for the music, Henry said.
He rubbed his eyes, trying to forget the news that she and her family would soon be leaving again. Everything felt so serious and final. He interrupted the moment with a smile of his own.
This is for you. Happy birthday.
Henry handed Keiko the first of the two presents he'd brought, slipping it carefully between the rows of barbed wire to keep from snagging the wrapping paper. Keiko took it graciously and carefully untied the ribbon, folding it into a neat bundle.
I'm saving this. ribbon like this in camp is like a present in itself.
Henry watched as she did the same with the lavender wrapping paper before opening the package, the size of a small shoebox.
Oh, Henry.
She took out the sketchbook, the tin of watercolors, and the set of horsehair brushes, then a set of drawing pencils, each of a different softness of lead.
Do you like it? Henry, I absolutely adore it. This is so wonderful. You're an artist. Seemed like it would be a shame to be here, away from what you're so good at, Henry said. Did you look inside the sketchbook?
Keiko set the small box down on a dry patch of dirt. The mud from the previous week had hardened, creating a desert of textured soil.
She opened the small black hand-bound sketchbook and read the price tag.
$1.25. Oops, here.
Henry reached in and peeled off the price tag from the stationer where he'd bought it.
You weren't supposed to see that. Look on the next page.
Keiko turned the page and read the inscription aloud.
To Keiko, the sweetest, most beautiful American girl I've ever known. Love, your friend Henry.
He watched her eyes moisten as she read it again.
Henry, that's so sweet. I don't know what to say.
He had felt awkward writing the word love in the sketchbook. He must have stared at that blank page, worrying about what to write for 20 minutes, before he finally just wrote it in ink. No turning back then.
Just say thank you, and that'll be fine.
She looked at him between the wires. The wind picked up and blew her hair away from her face. Thunder could be heard rumbling somewhere over the foothills, but neither looked away.
I don't think thank you is enough. You've come a long way to bring me this. And I know your family. Your father.
Henry looked down and exhaled softly.
He knows, doesn't he?
Keiko asked. Henry nodded.
But we're just friends.
Henry looked her in the eye.
We're more than friends. We're the same people. But he doesn't see it. He only sees you as a daughter of the enemy.
He's disowned me.
My parents stopped speaking to me this week, but my mother still sort of acts like I'm around.
The words came out so casually, even Henry was surprised at how normal it felt. But communication in his home had been far from ordinary for almost a year. This was just a new, final wrinkle. Keiko looked at Henry, shocked, with sadness in her eyes.
I'm sorry. I never meant for any of this to happen. I feel terrible. How could a father treat his son? It's all right. He and I never talked that much to begin with. It's not your fault. I wanted to be with you. When you first came to the school, I was shocked and a little surprised. But going to school without you, it just hasn't been the same. I miss you. I'm so glad you're here, Keiko said, as she touched the pointed metal of the fence. I miss you too.
I brought you something else. Henry offered her the other package through the barbed wire.
It's just a little surprise. Might not be too handy now, with the poor weather and all.
Keiko unwrapped the second package as carefully as she had the first.
How did you find this?
She whispered in awe, holding up the Oscar Holden record in its faded paper sleeve.
I couldn't get into the Panama Hotel, and they were sold out in town. But Sheldon gave me his. I guess it's from both of us. Too bad you can't play it tonight, with the concert canceled and all. We still have the record player in our building. I'll play it anyway. Just for you. Actually, just for us.
That made Henry smile. Parents? What parents?
You couldn't possibly know how happy I am to have this. This is almost like having you here with me. Not that I'd want to subject you to a place like this. But we've had no music. I'll be playing this every day.
Thunderclaps struck overhead, turning what had become a drizzle into a cloudburst, first in a few spare droplets, then widening into a thick, drenching downpour. Henry gave Keiko the last bag, the one from Woolworth's, with stationery, stamps, and fabric for blackout curtains.
"You'd better go," he insisted. "I don't want to leave you. We just got here. You'll get sick in this weather, living in a place like this. You need to go. I'll be back next week. I'll find you."
"Visiting hours are over," a soldier barked, wrapping himself in a green raincoat as he gathered up his files. "Everyone away from the fence."
The rain was rippling the ground, the sound drowning out their voices. To Henry, it seemed to go from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock, as the dark clouds dimmed the skyline, hiding the sun altogether. A dull gray glow illuminated the surface of the ground as it transformed back into the muddy, soggy field it had been earlier that week. Keiko reached through the fence and held Henry's hands.
"Don't forget about me, Henry. I won't forget about you. And if your parents don't want to speak to you, I'll speak to them and tell them you're wonderful for doing this. I'll be here every week."
She let go and fastened the top button on her coat.
"Next week?"
Henry nodded.
"I'll write to you then," Keiko said, waving goodbye as the last of the visitors filed away from the fence line and back toward the main gate.
Henry was the last to leave, standing there soaking wet, watching Keiko as she made it all the way back to a small outbuilding near the livestock pavilion that had become her new home. He could almost see his breath. It was growing so cold, yet inside, he felt warm. As it grew darker, Henry noticed the searchlights in the machine gun towers torched to life. The tower guard shone them up and down the fence line, illuminating Henry and the other visitors as they puddle-jumped their way back past the main gate. Henry turned down the hill toward Mrs. Beatty's truck. In the dark, he could see her massive outline, strapping down empty fruit crates in the back, her face illuminated by the cherry-red embers of her lit cigarette, dangling from her mouth. Through the slosh of the rain, Henry heard music from the camp. The song grew louder and louder, straining the limits of the speakers it came from. It was the record. Their record. Oscar Holden's Alley Cat Strut. Henry could almost pick out Sheldon's part. It shouted at the night, louder than the storm. So loud, a guard near the gate started hollering, "Turn off that music!" The searchlight swept down on the buildings in Area 4, beaming down a menacing eye, searching for the source. Moving, 1942. Henry finally received the news he'd been dreading all summer. He'd known it was only a matter of time. Keiko would be moving farther inland. Camp Harmony was always intended to be temporary, just until permanent camps could be built, away from the coastlines, which were seen as a vulnerable target for bombing or invasion. In these coastal communities, every Japanese citizen was a potential spy, able to keep track of the comings and goings of warships and ocean-based supply lines. So the farther inland the Japanese could be sent, the better. The safer we'll all be. That was what Henry's father had told him, at least back in the days when he actually spoke to him. It didn't matter. The words still rang in his ears, even in the awkward silence of their little Canton Alley apartment. Keiko had taken to writing him once a week. Sometimes she'd include a wish list of items that he and Mrs. Beatty could smuggle into the camps. Small things, like a newspaper, or big things, like forgotten records and copies of birth certificates. Other times it was practical things, like tooth powder and soap. There was a shortage of everything inside the camps. Henry wasn't sure if he'd even get Keiko's letters at first. He was certain his father would tear up any letter or note coming from Camp Harmony. But somehow, Henry's mother, sorting the mail first, found the letter each week and slipped it underneath his pillow.
She never said a word, but Henry knew it was her doing. She did her best to be an obedient wife, to honor her husband's wishes, but to look out for her son as well. Henry wanted to thank her. But even in private, expressing his gratitude would have been bad form. Just acknowledging that she was bending the rules set by Henry's father would be taken as an admission of guilt. So he, too, said nothing. But he was indeed grateful. Keiko's current letter said that her father had left already. He had volunteered to go to Camp Minidoka in Idaho, near the Oregon border. He'd offered to be part of a work detail, to help build the camp, the mess halls, the living quarters, even a school. Keiko had mentioned that her father used to be a lawyer, but now was working alongside doctors, dentists, and other professional men. All were now day laborers, toiling in the hot summer sun for pennies a day. Evidently, their efforts were worth it. The men who volunteered all wanted to stay as close to their original homes as possible. Plus, they were promised that their families could join them as soon as the camp was ready. Other families had been split up, some to Texas, and others to Nevada. At least the Okabes would be together. Henry knew he didn't have much time. This Saturday would probably be his last visit to Camp Harmony. His last chance to see Keiko for a very long while. Henry had been inside Area 4 almost a dozen times now, in the kitchen, in the mess hall, or up at the visitor's fence, talking to Keiko, and occasionally her parents through the barbed wire, lost among the half-dozen other groups of visitors who usually populated the fence during the day. But he'd never been into the camp itself, the large common area, the parade grounds that once were the heartbeat of the state fair. Now it was a dusty, occasionally muddy field, beaten down by the thousands of footsteps of restless internees. Today would be different. Henry had become used to the strangeness of the place. The guard dogs had patrolled the main gate, the machine gun towers, even the sight of men everywhere with bayoneted rifles slung across their backs. It all seemed so normal now. But today, during the normal routine of his Saturday in the mess hall, Henry planned to visit Keiko. Not at the fence. He was going into the camp. He was going to find her. So when most of the prisoners had been served their dinner, when the crowd began to thin, Henry excused himself to go to the latrine. The other kitchen helper could handle the small crowds that trickled in late. He hadn't seen Keiko come through yet. She tended to come late. That way she'd be able to spend time talking to Henry without holding up the line. Henry returned to the kitchen and left through the back door, right past Mrs. Beatty, who was out smoking a cigarette and talking to one of the supply sergeants. If she noticed him, she didn't say a thing. But then again, she rarely did anyway. Instead of heading for the latrine, Henry looped back around the building and blended into a crowd of Japanese prisoners, heading to the large trophy barn that had become a makeshift home for what he guessed were 300 people. He stuffed his "I am Chinese" button into his pocket. "If I'm caught," Henry thought, "they'll probably never let me come here again. Mrs. Beatty will be furious. But if Keiko's leaving, I won't be coming back anyway, so what does it matter? Either way, this is my last weekend at Camp Harmony. Keiko's too." If the men and women thought it was odd that a Chinese boy was following them back to their quarters, they didn't say a word. They just spoke to each other in English and Japanese both, talking about the impending move. The conversation that seemed to echo in every area of the camp. It would be this coming week. Henry was certain of it now. Nearing the large building where most of the families in Area 4 lived, Henry was amazed at how normal life had become here. Grandfatherly old men sat in homemade chairs smoking pipes, while small children played hopscotch in Foursquare. Clusters of women tended to long lines of laundry, and even weeded small gardens that had been planted in the barren soil. Henry slipped through the main entrance of the building, a huge sliding barn door that had been left open to allow cool air to seep into the sweltering interior.
Inside were rows and rows of stalls, most covered with makeshift privacy curtains hung by pieces of rope. Henry realized that the lucky ones had windows, bringing fresh air inside. The unlucky ones, well, they made do the best they could. Henry could hear a flute playing somewhere, among the noise of the crowds, which was surprisingly subdued the farther in he walked. Each stall accommodated one family, but they had evidently been cleaned by the new residents and didn't smell like horses or cows. Not in the slightest, much to Henry's surprise. Walking down the hallways between the rows of makeshift homes, Henry had no idea how he would find Keiko or her family. Some families had put up signs or banners in Japanese, English, and sometimes both. But many more stalls were left bare. Then he saw a sign above a curtain and knew this was where Keiko lived. The banner was written in English and read, "Welcome to the Panama Hotel." Henry knocked on a wooden beam making up one corner of the stall. He knocked again.
"Konnichiwa?
Donata desu ka?" came from behind the curtain. Henry recognized the phrase as, "Who is it?" The voice was Keiko's. When had she learned to speak Japanese? Then again, when had Henry started saying konnichiwa?
"Is there a vacancy at the hotel?" he asked.
There was a pause.
"Maybe. But you might not like it. The sento bath in the basement is awfully crowded these days." She knew.
"I'm just passing through. Wouldn't mind staying for a while if you have room."
"Let me check with my manager."
"Nope. Sorry. We're all full. Maybe if you try the pig barn two buildings over. I hear they have some very nice rooms." Henry wandered off, taking noisy, exaggerated steps.
"Okay, thanks for the tip. Have a nice day."
Keiko pulled back the curtain.
"For the boy who chased me down in the train station with soldiers running around, you sure give up easy."
Henry spun on his heel and walked back to where Keiko stood, then looked around the building, taking it all in.
"Where's your family?"
"Mom took my little brother to see the doctor about an earache he's been having. And you know about my dad. He left a week ago. He's finishing the roofing at the camp in Idaho. Our next stop. I've always wanted to travel. I guess this is my chance."
Henry watched Keiko's face turn serious.
"You've crossed some sort of line coming all the way down here, haven't you, Henry?"
He just looked at her. She wore a yellow summer dress and sandals. Her hair was pulled back with a white ribbon from the present he had given her on her birthday. Strands of black hair fell at the sides of her face, which had tanned quite a bit since she'd been at Camp Harmony. He shrugged.
"I'm breaking a lot of rules to be down here right now. But it's okay." "Of course, you know I'm leaving then, don't you?" Keiko asked. "You got my letter. You know we're all leaving."
Henry nodded, feeling sad but not wanting to show it, afraid that it might make Keiko feel even worse.
"They're taking us to Minidoka next week. Buses have already taken some families from the other areas. I wish you could come with us."
"Me too," Henry confessed. "I would if I could."
"Don't tell me you haven't thought about it."
"About you coming with us? Or me leaving with you?"
"Either, I guess." "There's no place for me to go, Henry. Nihomachi doesn't exist anymore. And I need to be here with my family. And you need to be with yours."
"I understand. We're not that different, you know."
"I don't have much to go home to. But I can't go with you either. Though I've thought about trying to blend in. How easy it would be to just get swept up in it all. To tag along. But I'm Chinese, not Japanese. They'd find out. Everyone would find out. I can't hide who I am. My parents would find out too, and they'd know where I'd gone.
We'd all get in a lot more trouble than we'd know what to do with.
So what brings you all the way down here? Or is Mrs. Beatty with you?
Keiko asked, looking up and down the rows of stalls.
How do I say this? Henry thought. What can I say that will make any difference to anyone?
I just had to come see you, face to face, to tell you how sorry I am for the way I acted that first day at school.
I don't understand. I was afraid of you. Honestly. Afraid of what my father might say or do. My father had said so many things, I just didn't know what to think. I didn't have any Japanese friends, let alone any...
Henry couldn't bring himself to say the word girlfriends, but he trailed off in a way that he was certain Keiko knew what he meant. Keiko smiled and looked up at him, her brown eyes unblinking.
It's just that this is probably our last time together, for a very long time. I mean, we don't know when you're ever coming back, or if you'll even be let back. I mean, there are senators that want to send you all back to Japan, win or lose.
It's true, Keiko nodded. I'll still write, if you want me to.
Does your father know about the letters?
Henry shook his head no. He reached out and took her hands in his, feeling her soft skin, looking at her slender fingers, slightly dirty from working in the camp.
I'm sorry I've caused so much trouble in your family, Keiko said. I'll stop writing if that will make it better for you at home.
Henry exhaled deeply.
I'll turn 13 soon. The same age my father was when he left home and began working full-time back in the old country. I'm old enough to make my own decisions.
Keiko leaned in closer.
And what decision is that, Henry?
He searched for the words. Nothing he ever learned in English class at Rainier Elementary could describe what was going on inside him. He'd seen movies where the hero takes the girl, where the music comes to a crescendo. He wanted so badly to wrap his arms around her and hold her and somehow keep her from going. But he also lived in a home where the most dramatic display of emotion was usually a nod and occasionally a smile. He'd just assumed all families were that way. All people, too. Until he met Keiko and her family.
It's just that...
Henry stammered.
What am I doing? I need to let her go, so she can be with her family, with her own community.
I need to let her move on.
I'm going to miss you,
he said, letting go of her hands and putting his own in his pockets, looking at his feet. Keiko looked crushed.
More than you know, Henry.
For the next hour, Henry stayed there, listening to Keiko talk about the little details, like what kinds of toys her father was making for her little brother, or how difficult it was to sleep with the noisy old lady who snored and broke wind through the night, even though she herself never woke up. The time passed quickly. Never once did they mention missing each other or how they felt again. They were together, alone even, but they might as well have been standing up at the visitor's fence, Henry on one side, Keiko on the other, separated by razor wire. Stranger, 1942. The ride home was more quiet than usual. Henry stared out the passenger window, watching the sun set one last time, watching the farmland give way to the landscape of Boeing Field, its enormous buildings draped in camouflage netting, a feeble attempt to keep entire factories hidden from enemy bombers. Henry didn't say a word, and Mrs. Beatty, perhaps out of sympathy, didn't either. She just left him to his thoughts, all of which were about Keiko. With the last of the prisoners taken to camps farther inland, Camp Harmony would revert back to being the site of the Washington State Fair, just in time for the fall harvest season. Henry wondered if anyone going to the fair this year would feel different, walking through the trophy barn, admiring prized heads of cattle. He wondered if anyone would even remember that 2 months earlier, entire families had been sleeping there. Hundreds of them. But what now? Keiko would be on her way to Minidoka, Idaho in a few days. A smaller work camp somewhere in the mountains near the Oregon border, he presumed. It was closer than Crystal City, Texas, but still seemed like a world away. Their goodbye had been a formal one. After he'd decided to let her go, for her own good, he reminded himself. He'd kept a polite distance, not wanting to make it any harder on either of them. She was his best friend. More than a friend, really. Much more. The thought of her leaving was killing him. But the thought of telling her how he really felt, and then watching her go, that was more than his small heart could manage. Instead, he said goodbye with a wave and a smile. Not even a hug. She looked away, wiping her eyes with the backs of her hands. He'd done the best thing, right? His father had said once that the hardest choices in life aren't between what's right and what's wrong, but between what's right and what's best. The best thing was to let her go, and Henry had done just that. But his mind had filled with doubts. To his surprise, no one had even noticed he was gone. Or if they had, they hadn't cared enough to say anything. The truth was, the residents of Camp Harmony would be leaving, and the camp workers, the soldiers, all just wanted to go back to their lives. They had done their duty, and were ready to wash their hands of the whole ugly matter once and for all. Mrs. Beatty was thoughtful enough to drop Henry off in Chinatown, a block from the apartment he shared with his family. She had never done that before. "I guess that's that," she said. "Stay out of trouble this summer, and don't go changing schools on me now. I still expect to see you in the kitchen this fall, got it?" Mrs. Beatty let the engine idle as she stubbed out a cigarette in a beanbag ashtray she kept on the dashboard for when the truck's ashtray got too full. "I'll be careful. I hope you hear some news about your father." "I'm sure he's doing okay," Henry said, thinking about Mrs. Beatty's father and the crew of the SS City of Flint, merchant marines imprisoned somewhere in Germany, like Keiko and her family. Mrs. Beatty smiled slightly, nodding. "Thank you, Henry. Mighty thoughtful of you. I'm sure he'll get by. You will too." She struggled to put the truck in gear, then regarded Henry once more. "And so will Keiko." He watched her drive off, bumping along the potholed streets, her arm waving out the window. Then she rounded the corner and was gone. The streets were peaceful. Henry listened for Sheldon playing over on Jackson, but heard only the rumble of trucks, the squeal of brakes, and a dog barking in the distance. He walked up the steps and down the hall to his apartment, the steamy smell of rice in the air. When he reached his home, the door was partially open, and light spilled out. A shadow moved, the silhouette of an older man, but not that of his father. Henry stepped inside. His mother was sitting at the kitchen table, sniffling into a handkerchief, her eyes red and her nose puffy from crying. Henry recognized the man immediately by the stethoscope that hung around his neck. Dr. Luke, one of the few Chinese doctors who had a practice on South King and still made house calls. He'd once come by when Henry had fallen off the swing at school, a beating, actually, courtesy of Chaz Preston, and had a concussion. Henry had thrown up and passed out, and his mother had immediately called the local doctor. But Henry had been fine, and his mother, despite the tears, looked reasonably well. This time, she looked scared, her body shaking. That's when Henry knew. "Henry,
Your mother was just talking about you. You look like you've grown since my last visit.
Dr. Luke was being polite, speaking in Chinese, but nervous too.
What isn't he telling me? Henry thought.
Henry's mother left her chair and fell to her knees, hugging him so hard it hurt.
What's the matter? Where's father?
Henry asked, guessing the answer. She propped herself up, wiping the tears from her eyes, and spoke in a positive tone that somehow didn't fit the news she was about to share.
Henry, your father's had a stroke. Do you know what that is?
He shook his head no, though he had some vague recollection of old man Wee in the fish market, who always talked funny and used only his right arm to weigh the day's catch.
Henry,
it's a very bad stroke, Dr. Luke said, putting his hands on Henry's small shoulders. Your father is tough and stubborn. I think he's going to pull through. But he's going to need rest for at least a month. And he can barely talk. He might gain some of that back, but for right now it's going to be difficult for all of us, especially him.
The only words Henry heard were, he can barely talk. Father had barely said anything when he could, and in the last 2 months hadn't said a single word to Henry. Not even a good night, not a hello or a goodbye.
Is he going to die?
Was all Henry could think of to ask, his voice cracking. Dr. Luke shook his head, but Henry saw through to the truth. He looked at his mother, and she looked terrified, not saying a thing. What could she say?
Why did this happen? How?
Henry asked his mother as well as Dr. Luke.
These things just happen, Henry, Dr. Luke answered. Your father gets worked up about so many things, and he's not a young man inside. He lived such a hard life back in China. It ages a body. And now so much worry with the war. A wave of guilt crashed over Henry. He was sinking beneath it. His mother took his hand.
Not your fault. Don't think this. Not your fault. His fault, understand?
Henry nodded to make his mother feel better, but he was torn inside. He had so little in common with his father. He had never understood him. But still, he was the only father he had, the only one he would ever have.
Can I see him? Henry asked.
Henry watched his mother's eyes meet Dr. Luke's. The doctor paused, then nodded. At the door of his parents' room, Henry could smell Buddha's incense burning, along with some kind of cleaning solution. His mother turned on a small lamp in the corner. As Henry's eyes adjusted, he beheld his father, looking small and frail. He lay like a prisoner of his bed, the covers pulled up tight around his chest, which seemed to move in a jerky, uneven rhythm. His skin was pale, and one side of his face looked bloated, like it had been in a fight, while the other side watched and did nothing. His arm lay at his side, palm up. A long tube connected at his wrist led to a bottle of clear fluid that hung from the bedpost.
"Go on, Henry. He can hear you," Dr. Luke said, prodding him forward.
Henry walked to the side of the bed, afraid that touching his father would injure him or push him closer to his ancestors.
"It's okay, Henry. I think he'd want to know you're here."
His mother gently caressed his nervous shoulder, taking his hand and putting it in his father's frail, limp fingers.
"Say something. Let him know you're here."
"Say something? What can I possibly say now? And in what language?" Henry took the I Am Chinese button off his shirt and set it on the nightstand near what he assumed to be his father's medicine. There were assorted brown glass bottles, some with labels in English, while others, herbal concoctions, were labeled in Chinese. Henry watched his father open his eyes, blinking twice.
Henry couldn't tell what lurked behind that stricken, expressionless face. Still, he knew what he had to say.
Duyamji?
It meant, I am unable to face a formal apology when you're admitting guilt or fault. Henry felt his mother's hand on his face for a moment, a caress of comfort. His father looked up at him, his mind straining to force his disobedient body into activity. Each movement of his mouth took incredible effort. Just breathing in and out enough to generate sound appeared nearly impossible. Still, his fingers gripped Henry so slightly it was almost imperceptible. And a single phrase slipped out.
Sang-yan.
It meant stranger. As in, you are a stranger to me.
13, 1942. 1 month later, Henry grew up, or so it felt. He turned 13, the age that many laborers had left China 2 generations earlier in search of Jinshan, the Gold Mountain, seeking their fortunes in America. It was the same age his father had been when he took a job as a laborer, the age Henry's father considered a boy to be a man, or a girl to be a woman for that matter, since arranged marriages often happened as early as 13, the age a girl's education typically ended, and only for those who could afford such arrangements. Henry's birthday came and went with little fanfare. His mother made goal, a favorite dessert cake of glutinous sticky rice, she normally reserved for special holidays, like Lunar New Year. His extended family of aunties and cousins came over for a dinner of black bean chicken and choi sum with oyster sauce, also favorites of Henry's. His rich Auntie King gave a Malay Sea envelope, filled with 10 crisp $1 bills, more money than he'd ever received at one time. She gave Henry's mother one, too. His mother gushed her appreciation, but didn't open it. That was when Henry realized that Auntie King and her husband Herb were probably helping support Henry's family now that his father was bedridden. Henry's father was confined to his bed, or a wheelchair that his mother pushed around the apartment, positioning him next to the radio, or the window so he could get some fresh air once in a while. He said nothing to Henry, but would whisper words to Henry's mother, who doted on him as best she could. Occasionally, Henry would catch his father watching him, but when he'd make eye contact, his father would look away. He wanted to say something, feeling guilty for having disobeyed, for having caused his father's weakened condition. But in a way, he was his father's son, and he could be equally stubborn. Keiko had been gone more than a month. She'd left on August 11th, with the last of the prisoners of Camp Harmony, bound for Minidoka. And she'd never once written. Of course, no one could be sure what that really meant. Maybe there wasn't mail service up there. Or maybe Henry had been too clear with his goodbye, and she was moving on without him, forgetting him once and for all. Either way, he missed her so much, it hurt. Especially at school, when the fall semester started. Henry had 2 more years before he'd go to Garfield High, which he'd heard was far more integrated, and where most of the Chinese and black kids ended up going. A mixed-race class would be such a change from Rainier, where he was, once again, the only non-white student. He still worked in the kitchen at lunchtime with Mrs. Beatty, who never spoke of Keiko. Henry rarely saw Chaz anymore. Since getting caught vandalizing homes in Nihomachi, he had been kicked out of Rainier. Rumor had it, he was now bullying kids at Bailey Gatzert, where all the blue-collar kids went. Occasionally, Henry would see him shadowing his father around town, but that was it. He'd grin at Henry, but Henry wasn't afraid of him anymore. Chaz looked the way he'd look for the rest of his life, Henry thought, bitter and defeated. Henry, on the other hand, still felt like he hadn't learned his best trick yet. Still, Henry's work duties after school felt empty, and his walk home was a lonely affair. All he could do was think of Keiko, how happy he'd felt when she was around,
and how numb and sad he'd felt, watching her wipe the tears from her eyes when he'd said goodbye. He didn't regret watching her go as much as he regretted not telling her how much he cared, how much she meant. His father was a horrible communicator. After all the time he'd rebelled against his father's wishes and his father's ways, Henry hated the fact that he wasn't that different from him at all. Not where it mattered, anyway. Henry walked back to the black iron arches of Chinatown, alone again, following the unmistakable sound of Sheldon Sachs and the roar of applause that always seemed to accompany his performances these days. Sheldon was playing in small clubs around South Jackson, but Oscar Holden was on a police watch list now for speaking out against the treatment of the residents of Nihomachi and had a hard time getting gigs. The price you pay for speaking your mind, you lose the ability to have your singing voice heard. A tragedy, Henry thought. No, more than a tragedy. It was a crime, having that ability stolen from him. His record had sold out and became sort of a collector's item. For a while, anyway.
"Hear anything from up yonder?"
Sheldon saw Henry and pointed with his chin, eastward, in the direction of Idaho, in the direction of Minidoka. Henry shook his head no, trying not to look as down as he felt.
"I've been to Idaho once. It's not that bad. I had a cousin that would run liquor across the border, into Post Falls years ago, during Prohibition. It's pretty, all those mountains and such."
Henry slouched on the curb. Sheldon handed him his empty lunch pail.
"Oh, it's been a long time since I was what anyone might have called a young man. But boy," he said, "I can see it in your eyes. I know you're trying to put on your brave face, that face that even your mama might not see through. But me, Henry, I've seen enough hard luck in my lifetime. I know what you got, and you got it bad."
Henry stole a peek at Sheldon.
"What? That obvious?"
"We all felt it, boy. Watching everyone get rounded up like that. That's enough heartbreak to last a lifetime for some people. Down here, in the so-called international district, you, me, the Filipinos, them Koreans coming over, even some of the Jews and Italians, we all felt it. But you, it hurt you in a different way. Watching her go.
I let her go.
Henry, she was going whether you let her go or not. It's not your fault.
No, I let her go. I didn't even really say goodbye, as much as I sent her away.
There was a moment of silence as Sheldon fingered the keys on his sacks.
Then you get yourself to some pen and paper and you write to her.
Henry interrupted.
I don't even know her address. I let her go, and she hasn't even written to me.
Sheldon pursed his lips and let out a big sigh, closing his sax case and sitting on the cold cement curb next to Henry.
You know where Minidoka is, right?
I can find it on a map.
Then let's go see her. They must have visiting hours up there, just like down in Puyallup. Let's you and me jump in the belly of the big dog and go see her.
Big dog?
Greyhound, boy. I have to spell it all out for you. We catch a bus. I ain't got nothing but time right now anyway. We leave on a Friday, come back on a Sunday. You don't hardly miss no school or nothing.
I can't do that.
Why? You're 13 now, ain't you? You're a man in your daddy's eyes. You can make a man's decision and do what you gotta do. That's what I'd do.
I can't just leave my mother. And what about my father?
What about him?
I can't just leave him. If he found out I'd gone all the way to Idaho to see a Japanese girl, his heart would give out completely.
Henry. Sheldon looked at him more seriously than he'd ever done before.
Your daddy, having himself a heart fit, that ain't your fault either. He's been fighting the war in his head, in his heart, ever since he was your age back in China. You can't take credit for stuff that goes back to before you even born. You understand me?
Henry stood up and brushed the dirt off the seat of his pants
I gotta go. I'll see you around.
He smiled, as much as he could, and walked off in the direction of home. Sheldon didn't argue. He's right, Henry thought. I am old enough to make my own decisions. But Idaho? That's too far, too dangerous. What business do I have running off like that, to a place I've never been? If something happened to me, who would take care of my mother? With my father bedridden, I'm the man now. I might even have to quit school and go to work to help pay bills. And besides, running off wasn't responsible. The more he thought about it, the more he realized that money wasn't an issue. The money from working at Camp Harmony was more than enough to pay his way, and the windfall from Auntie King would cover everything else. No, I can't do it. It just isn't practical right now. When Henry got home, his father was in bed, sound asleep. Since the stroke, he didn't even snore as loudly as he used to. Seemed like everything he did was a pale shadow of his former self, except his spotlight of condemnation, which always seemed to shine on Henry. No matter where Henry was, he felt it. His mother came up the stairs behind him with a basket of laundry taken from the clothesline shared by others in the alley.
You have a birthday card, she said in Cantonese.
She took it out of her apron pocket and handed it to him. It was a bright yellow envelope, slightly bent and dirty. Henry recognized the stamp. He knew who it was from just by the handwriting. It was from Minidoka. From Keiko. She hadn't forgotten him. He looked at his mother, a little bewildered, but not apologizing. It's okay, was all she said, as she walked away with the basket of clean laundry. Henry didn't even go to his room to open it. He carefully peeled it open right there and read the letter inside. At the top of the page was a small pen and ink drawing of a birthday cake, colored with watercolor. It read,
Happy birthday, Henry. I didn't want you to go, but I knew I was going anyway, so what could you do? I don't want to trouble your family or make things worse between you and your dad. I just wanted to let you know I was thinking about you and miss you more than you'll know.
The rest was about camp life, how they had a school there, and how her father was doing. His law degree wasn't much good to him when it came time to pick sugar beets every day. And the letter closed with,
I won't write you again. I don't want to bother you. Maybe your father is right. Keiko.
Henry's fingers shook when he read the last line again and again. He looked at his mother, who was now in the kitchen and had been watching him from the corner of her eye. She held her hand to her lips, looking concerned. Henry half smiled at her and found his way to his room, where he counted out the money he'd saved all summer and the lucky money from Auntie King. He then found an old suitcase at the top of his closet and filled it with enough clothes and clean underwear to last a few days. Walking out of his room, he felt like an entirely different person from the one who had walked in. His mother looked at him, blanketed in confusion. Suitcase in hand, he headed for the door.
I'm going to the bus station. I'll be back in a few days. Don't wait up for me.
I knew you'd do the right thing, Sheldon said, smiling from the aisle passenger seat of the Greyhound bus bound for Walla Walla. I knew you had it in you. Saw it in your eyes.
Henry just looked out the window as the city streets of Seattle gave way to green hills up and toward the pass between western and eastern Washington. He'd found Sheldon, and his suitcase in hand was all the prompting his friend had needed.
Let me get my hat, was Sheldon's only response,
and the two of them gathered their things and headed for the bus depot, where they bought two round-trip tickets to Jerome, Idaho, the closest town to Camp Minidoka. The tickets cost $12 each. Henry offered to pay for Sheldon's out of the money he'd saved up from working that summer, but Sheldon declined.
Thanks for coming with me. You didn't have to pay. I had enough.
It's okay, Henry. I never get out of the city enough anyway.
Henry was grateful. Deep down, he'd wanted to save enough money, at least enough